to Your Ball Was Out podcast presented by Phil from Tweener Head Tennis. This is the podcast where we talk everything tennis, from player interviews to tennis news to tennis coaches to tennis equipment and any news out there to let you guys know about the tennis world. Now, we have a very special guest for you today. We have Jonathan Stoke, aka Stokey, who is a viral tennis coach. And if you don't know who he is, he's coached club level. He's coached college level. He's coached pro level. He was actually down in Charleston when we reached out to him, helping out Jessica Pegula, new world number three, to talk about his experience working with her and to help her see her succeed at the Charleston Open, where she won the title. Now, we are very excited to have him on, but before you guys enjoy this interview, make sure you leave a 5-star review on the podcast on whichever platform you are listening to this on, and make sure you're following the podcast so that way you don't miss any drops with content that we have throughout the week. And now, enjoy our conversation with Jonathan Stoke, aka Stokey. Thank you so much for joining me today, man. It's not every day we get to have someone like you in your caliber on the channel and the podcast, but thank you so much for joining us today. If you don't know who Jonathan is, you're not following any experienced tennis accounts on Instagram, let's just say that. And Jonathan was very fortunate to be in Charleston this week to help out Jessica Pegula, which is incredible. So Jonathan, welcome to the channel.
Yeah, it's great to be here. For those that don't know, first of all, I'm not Pegula's coach, but I have known her since she was 7.
Yes.
I was hitting in her lessons from an early age, probably up until she was 12. Mm-hmm. And we've obviously kept in touch. Mm-hmm. She's almost like a little sister at times. And mainly I would say I communicate her maybe when she's not playing as well is when I get more text messages.
Okay.
So I can be a sounding board for her when there's mm-hmm. some frustrating stuff going on. But she played awesome. She's in great shape. Mentally, she was in a great spot. I was at her practice the first day of the week, and I didn't think she was necessarily going to win because that's difficult to do, but I felt very good about where she was.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't mean to put you on the spot like that, but not saying you are her coach, but you do work with her at times and kind of seeing the different areas that she has succeeded in and struggled with. What has been, when you have someone that you've been a part of someone's life for that long, how hard is it or how easy is it for you to kind of communicate what you need to communicate to someone that you have such a long history with?
I personally think it's very easy as long as I think what's easy about it for me is that I'm not very emotional.
Okay.
And so if I'm ever, whether I've known her for 25 years or I meet a player for 1 week, the information is separate than it's not you are a bad person. I'm angry that you can't solve this. It's just like, hey, I'm watching up close and like, it looks like, you're cheating too much the middle and you're getting beat forehand cross. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just information. It's not a judgment. It's not anything. And so, you know, especially with her, if she ever asked me for my thoughts, I just tell her exactly what I'm seeing and she can take it or leave it, or a player can take it or leave it. But it's never, there's never an emotion behind it or a judgment behind it. I think that's where communication can get blurry. And that's where there are a couple people at the tournament who have either fiancés or spouses or boyfriend, girlfriend who are doing the coaching. Mm-hmm. And that's where it gets tricky, right? Because it always feels like there's something more to that information, a little bit of judgment or a little bit behind it, instead of just being like, yeah, like you're not keeping your arm up on your serve. Like that's just a fact, right? So I try to keep it very, very clear and just almost like I'm presenting a factual information and then just saying, hey, by the way, I could be wrong. So take it or leave it. It's not my way or the highway. And I think that's been a very good way for me to keep relationships separate from coaching.
Did it take you long to kind of develop that mindset? Because as a coach, you get very, from my own experience too, you get very involved in how you want a player to feel and how you want them to feel on court versus, okay, how do I separate their off court, maybe struggles that they're having, to their on court? How do you separate that, or how did you develop that mindset to kind of help players separate the two, or how did you separate the two, for to be more specific?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, because I would say early on I was just much more about the information and I didn't spend a whole lot of time thinking about how they would receive it or what's going on in their life, because that's how I am. I don't care. Like, if you're coaching me in anything, you don't need to know anything about my, just go tell me what to do. I'm coming to you as an expert. I want you to tell me what to do and I will do it. So I'm probably a coach's dream in that sense. But I learned that that is not the majority of people. And so then I had to start learning in the last couple of years, like, okay, I have to know what's going on in their life. I have to know how they want to receive information. I have to know when they're not ready to receive it. There are plenty of times I want to say something and I'm like, damn, I just have to not say it. I just have to wait till they're ready, unfortunately. So yeah, that's something that I learned the hard way, because I would say at Duke in particular, like, I was just giving out information. And when guys weren't receiving it or weren't using it, I couldn't figure it out. And a lot of that was that soft skill of kind of figuring out what was going on in their lives, how they needed to hear it at that moment, or maybe saying, hey, I'll wait a week and then give it to them, then they'll be receptive. So I think I learned a little bit of the hard way at Duke, but yeah, just what I'm learning now is that is the main skill. Is, of course, all these coaches know a lot about tennis, but it's not what you know. It's communicating in a way that it resonates with that particular player.
And I think that's for everyone too when it's coaching. And anytime I ask a college coach when I do these interviews or pro players and how they want to be coached, it's always different, right? And it's always going to be a different personality, a different way of learning, a different approach to understanding how they can develop their game and develop themselves as human beings, right? Especially at the college level. And you mentioned something that said, wait until they are ready. In that sense, I feel like that's such a tricky thing to do because of how specific or how frustrated a player can be in that sense, right? And when they aren't ready to listen or learn, and there's such a short window, how do you get someone to be ready, even if their window is closing, to kind of change the game or make the game quote go to, their way?
Sorry, I lost you in the middle of that one. It
No, you're
froze
fine.
up there. You're saying when a player isn't ready, and
Yeah,
then I lost you for a second.
when you said that you wait until they're ready to receive the information, correct?
Correct. Yep.
How do you, and there's such a finite window sometimes in a match where players need to either take that information and use it, or they have to, or they just don't want that information, and then it becomes too late for them to adjust their game and it doesn't go their way. How do you pick the right time to say, because they could, honestly, a player could never be ready to hear the information that you're giving, right?
Yeah, I mean, and when that's the case, like, they're in a bad spot. And that's where I'd say, like, then you have to do a lot of work in between, being like, hey, we can't get you into that mode where you're not able to be coached. Like, that is a rough spot. And by the way, I've had that happen many times where I do just stop to I leave the court. If it was college, I'd just be like, okay, that court, I can't help today. Like, it's just, why would I even keep standing there? Like, they're not listening. I can tell emotionally they're a mess. And it's like, hey, I'm not going to get through to them. I got to go find someone I could actually maybe help. And then in between, after that match, I'd go, hey, we got to figure out how to not get you in that mode. Obviously, typically, if a player will literally ask you, okay, fine, they're probably a little more open than not. And that's part of the skill, is looking at someone's body language and looking at how they're acting. You know, if a player misses a couple shots and they're throwing the racket, or they're looking really pissed and they got a nasty look on their face, it's probably not the right time for me to be like, hey, by the way, can you make sure you don't let them hit that same winner down the line? Like, they're going to be like, yeah, no duh. Like, even though they didn't cover it, they don't want to hear it at that time. So hopefully a lot of that work is done in between matches, right? But sometimes someone has to lose enough to get to the breaking point where now they actually, hey, I'm dying. Can you please tell me why I'm losing? And you go, yeah, because you're letting them beat you with a forehand cross court and they're incapable of hitting a forehand line, and you've made that mistake 20 times. And they go, oh, thank you. Okay, good. And then they can go use it. But there's times where they don't want to hear it. So it's reading that body language. But I do think, as with anything, most of the work, if you're saving it for in the middle of a match when tensions are high, good luck with that. You know, you need to be doing it leading up to that, so you have a plan. Or you can even say, hey, remember when we talked about this Wednesday? And at least bring them back into something that's not in the emotion and the tension of that match.
Yeah, and you said too, the with especially on the college level, when you think that the court has too much emotion, they're not in the right headspace, that you can't really help that court. Is that perceived as harsh when you tell that to people or to players, especially players that have never kind of experienced college tennis or have seen that high level where it these are realistic situations and it's just the reality of the situation?
Do I think it's harsh for the player to hear that?
Anyone to hear that.
I mean, maybe it depends on the person receiving the information, but to me, again, that's just a fact. Like if that's the situation, if I go out there and I'm like, hey, you were struggling, you're down a break, and I said, hey, can you cover that wide serve? And then you got beat wide twice in a row. I'd be like, does that sound very coachable to you? Like, it's fine. There's nothing wrong with that other than you're probably going to lose. But like, that is just the fact, is you're not really taking information, or I gave you information and you shot back with a comment. And it's like, that doesn't seem like your optimal energy state to be like combative, especially with someone who's literally just here attempting to help you. And by the way, I'm not infallible, so I will give you, like, we were saying watching this, we had some feelings at times where we're like, oh, we really think Kennan is going to serve T, let's say. And I asked her coach, I was like, well, would you ever tell her? He's like, well, no, if I'm wrong, like, good luck with that. You know, like, in college, you know, if you tell someone, hey, cover that wide serve, and then someone blasts the tee down the ace, they're going to look at you like you're crazy. Like, you're not perfect either. So yeah, it's a super tricky thing. But again, to me, that's just information. Like, after the match, you could say, do you think you were coachable? Like, show me evidence that you're a coachable player in the moment. Are you receptive? Are you giving me good body language? Are you applying what I'm telling you early? Are you asking questions so you can understand it? If the answer to those questions are no, then unfortunately you're not very coachable, which is not a good or a bad thing. It's just, I'm not going to be able to help you in a live duel match.
That's fair. No, it's true because I think it's very different too around those aspects between college and pro, right? Because college, you can have teenagers that have an attitude, and you can have almost full grown adults that can have an attitude as well. When you see that on the pro tour, they have to be more receptive to understanding what's at stake and what you're trying to achieve in the match. Is it that big of a difference between coaching on the pro and college level?
I think pros are a little more set in their ways. Obviously, they're better. They're a little more comfortable with what they want to do. So I find, like, so, what, by the way, side note, when I don't watch college tennis much anymore, but when I do, I see a lot of overcoaching. It's every point they're walking on the court and having, it's like these kids play tennis their whole life without a coach. They're going to go to the pros and they're not going to do that. Like, that's not how pro coaching works. So I've watched a couple times, and I've texted some people I know, and I'm like, is this a new thing? Like, that we have to like have a walk and talk in between every single point all the time? Like, to me, that is wild. I forgot where I was going with this, with the pro coaching. You were saying,
The difference between the college and pro, how it seems like you're going along the lines of with college, there's so much overcoaching, and pro players are set in their ways of already playing. Like they already
yes.
have their own style.
Right. I mean, it's just, yeah. So there's not as much that you would say to a pro. I mean, again, you have a game plan. You watch the video and you say, this player loves their forehand cross. When they're on offense, they go line. You talk about all that stuff before. It's not like they're really looking at you for constant like help. They look to themselves, which is what you really want. I mean, we can't swing a racket for anyone. Like, it's up to them. The other side note I would say is, in the pros, I told Mark, Jesse's coach, I said, look, if someone asked me to go 10 weeks on tour, the first thing I would do is go to YouTube and learn how to read lips. I would do like lip reading courses, because they're playing music, the crowd is cheering, the player's on the ad court, you're on the other half, and we're like screaming at her. And she's looking at us and saying some things, and I look at him, I'm like, what the hell? What is she saying? I have no clue. Or we're looking at them on the changeover, and you can't just yell, hey, serve to her forehand, because the other girl's gonna hear it too. So I was like, man, it's like really, really difficult to communicate in the pros, and I've heard that before. And then just imagine if you're at Ash Stadium and you're 40 yards away
Like,
and
how are they
everyone's
going to see
talking all the
you?
time. Yeah, like, so they don't look at you as much as college, but that's one thing, is I'm like, man, we're really holding their hands in college, it looks like. Like, give them a little piece of feedback. Hopefully you went through the match already and go, now just go play for two games. And I'll clap for you if you hit a good shot. But like, I don't need to remind you every point, hopefully, to serve wide or to do whatever it is.
For it's interesting because I feel like on because you also coach club level, and for you, if we were to go to that side of coaching for you as well, with if we talk about overcoaching, I feel like a lot of players at the club level, and correct me if I'm wrong, I've known this from my own personal experience. Some players at the club level would want to be coached every single point and be told what to do because they want to hit the best possible shot and they don't want kind of to have be the culprit of their own dumb mistakes, right? Is there, so from that club level perspective, do they want to be more, or I would say overcoached in that aspect, or do you find it that you're trying to teach them more independence?
Definitely independence. And so I've heard this before with golf, and it applies to tennis too, which is tennis is so difficult that people try to make it complicated. So I
I love
love,
that. I
yeah,
love that.
it's great. And so I love when people, miss three returns of the net, like, what should I do? And I go, oh, you should definitely aim higher. But by the way, that is the answer. Like, that will fix 90% of their technical issues. And so then when they do it later, they look at me and I'll be like, yeah, just, another foot. Like that's all it is. And they don't need to hear that 25 times in a row because most people do make the same mistake. And so that's always my goal as a coach is I'm like, can you solve level one, level two, level three, level four? And that will either win you the match or you're gonna get to an unsolvable problem. You're playing someone who hits the ball so much better, there's no answer. And unfortunately, we're just gonna have to go shake hands. But don't get stuck on level one. And that's what a lot of recreational adults do. And so I don't need to keep telling them every point because I'm like, oh no, you're still there. Like, unfortunately, you're still hitting the middle of the net. That's what it is. And until you want to aim higher, like, there's nothing else for me to say. And I actually think they like that clarity because I do think they think it's super complicated and that they need overcoaching. And once they realize, like, it's really kind of like two or three things, then my job's easier because I don't have to keep saying it. And they take ownership and go, and until I solve those two things that are definitely in my control, he can't move on anyway. So I can't use him. So it puts a little pressure on them.
So what do you think the three things are that you, when you first meet someone that wants to get better, what are the first three things you tell them from your own philosophy or that you try to regurgitate into their own game plan?
I would say the biggest thing for me is targets. So before I even, I really don't, especially with people who come in for short periods of time, I don't really touch technique that much. Because I don't think it's going to change. I don't want to give them something and then ship them on the road and be like, good luck with that grip change or whatever. Like, that's not going to work. So I find that everybody hits way too low, way too fast, and way too close to the lines. And the reason why I know that is because they miss. So I always tell them, I want you to hit as fast as you can, as wide as you can, whatever height you want, as long as you're making the ball. And if you're a 3-0, that's unfortunately going to mean you're going to have to hit pretty damn slow, aim basically in the middle, and hit pretty high because you don't know where the ball's going. If I'm watching Pegula, which Pegula can, I mean, the hitting was unbelievable. Okay, well, you can hit an 85 mile an hour backhand 2 inches over the net for the most part, five or six times in a row. Okay, then do that. That's great. I don't want you to hit slower than that.
Because you can do that, because you have the
Exactly.
ability to do that.
Exactly. And you've proven that because you're making a vast majority of those balls. And so that's like the first thing is like convincing people that you don't have to do as much as you think. Like, it's always, how do I force my opponent to miss? And it's like, I don't know if you've watched 4-0 or 4-5 tennis. You don't have to do a whole lot. You just can't beat them to it, right? And so people can call that pushing or whatever. That's fine. I mean, the fact that you're not trying to hit a winner every point, like, that's really not the object of the game. But that is one of my biggest things that I stress. The second thing, if I was going to do like a physical thing, would be footwork. So when I used to go recruiting, and by the way, recruiting can be very, very boring when you're at a tournament all day. I'm talking to these coaches and I'm going, hey, like, what are the three things you want in a player? And the first two in any order, footwork and competitor. That's it. And then it would be forehand or serve would be the third thing. Coaches were like flipped on that. But like, hey, I need to have someone who can move, get to the ball, and then someone who either plays smart or tries hard, whatever their version of a competitor meant. And so for me, the competitor is playing smart. And so that's why I like good targets. I like people playing within themselves. And then I go, hey, by the way, we also got to be able to get to the ball. I don't really care if your forehand looks a certain way. I don't care if you got two hands. Some people come to me and say, I've got a two-hand backhand volley instead of a one. I'm like, I couldn't care less. Good for you. It's the same thing. Like, it's going to be the same thing. That does not matter to me in terms of you winning a match,
That's
right? Like,
amazing.
it's
That's
so low on the
amazing.
itinerary. So those two things for me are massive. And then I would also say just a very, very simple fundamental for me in anything in life is I keep it very, very simple. And so what I find is whether I'm talking about a target or talking about footwork or whatever the situation might be, I have one objective at any given time. I never have two. And most players, if I say, I want you to aim higher, if I gave you $1 billion to hit the ball over the net, I fed you a ball and said, it just has to go over, it doesn't even have to go in. There's no chance you would ever miss in the net. The problem is why people continue to make those mistakes is they try to do that one objective, but they're also trying to make the shot or win the point.
Yes.
And that just brings them back to their old habit. So I always go, hey, this is your one task in any given situation. Are you mature enough and smart enough to be able to execute that thing that, by the way, I will make very controllable? And once they commit to that, they go, oh my God, then their level starts going so fast because they're not worried about winning or making the shot. They're worried about getting better at the one skill, which obviously will help them improve.
Yeah, and I think too, it's for me, simplicity is always the easier. It's the most kind of out there, like you said before when we first started recording, it's simplicity is something that you just need to put into people's brains because it's not supposed to be difficult. This is, and one thing that I always kind of grew up with in understanding tennis is this is supposed to be fun. We're all supposed to be out there competing, having fun, having a good time. And the more complicated you make it for yourself, and the more ways you try to tweak things to find like that perfect feel, you won't achieve that. And there's no such thing as perfection in tennis, right? It's always the, you look at players and you look at how well they hit, but that's, you'll ask any tennis player, and this has always stuck with me too. If you ask any tennis player, when was the last time you played a perfect tennis match? They won't be able to recall one.
So you said something there that again, it's how they get conflated. I knew how you meant it, but you said, oh, it's not supposed to be difficult. I think it is supposed to be difficult. And then you also said, but it's not supposed to be complicated, which I do agree with. It should be simple. So that's the way I reframe it. So I play golf and padel, and I am probably the equivalent of like a 5-0 in both. Like I'm good, but I'm nothing special.
You're
But
not a scratch golfer yet. You're wearing the Masters hoodie. We have to at
I
least.
was, yeah, I actually was thinking about wearing my Masters hat today too.
Oh.
I was scratched for a while. I'm about to get back into golf. I'm probably like a 3 or a 4 handicap, but yeah,
Damn.
if it was easy, I promise you wouldn't enjoy it as much. And people kind of go, nah, I'd like to hit the ball like you, Stokey, in tennis. And I go, okay, cool. If you want to win 6-0, 6-0, I can go find you a 6-year-old right down at the little junior clinic and let's go play them a match 6-0, 6-0. And they go, well, that would be boring. And I go, yeah, you're right. It would be boring. Like that's how I would feel if I played a 4-0. It'd be very, very boring. So if you want to win easy against someone your own level, can you explain how that's ever going to happen? Of course it's not. You play someone your level, it's going to be this back and forth. You're going to play poorly. They're going to play poorly. You'll have some moments of greatness. 6-4, 4-6, 6-4, challenge. Hey, I have to lose some, so I enjoy winning. Like deep down, you like it because it's difficult. If it wasn't, you would get bored, I promise. And so when you reframe it and then you find yourself in that learning or struggling phase, you're like, oh, this is why I'm addicted to the game. Like if I just came out for a lesson and my forehand was perfect in a second, I wouldn't value it at all. It would be very boring. So I think it's a good reframe because everybody is always dealing with something that's difficult. And once you learn that you actually deep down kind of like it, it makes it easier.
And I think too, if we're going to go the lines with comparing with golf, like when you hit a shot in golf so clean and so pure, it's an addiction, right? You never want to get, you always want to hit it like that. You hit one like that, and then you're not hitting one for the next 2 hours. So it's, and you could probably relate to that. I could probably relate to that more than you can if you're a three handicap. Damn. But in that sense, too, you want it to be difficult because you enjoy the process. And that process has to be, you have to be willing to do the process in order to enjoy it, right?
Yes, I understand that I'm a different bird than most, but anyone can enjoy any game for whatever reason they want. If you're enjoying it because you like to hit the ball clean, that's awesome. I take a joy in being smart and maximizing what I have. So I love when I play a round of golf and I shoot a 73 and someone's like, wow, really? Like I watched it didn't look like that. And I'm like, yeah, because I'm so freaking smart. Like I got away with all this ugliness. That's what I value. doesn't mean that that's the right thing, but it's also something that is controllable. Like, I love hitting a bad shot and someone thinks I'm going to get upset. And I'm like, oh, yeah, it's like part of the deal. It's all good. I love being like, I'm so much smarter than that. I'm so in control of my emotions. I'm not going to get nervous. I'm not going to get upset. I like that strength and that power of owning kind of who I am and owning that process versus having my joy tied to something which is going to come and go. Like yesterday in Pagula's match, it's a wind tunnel. Like they're hitting so many awkward shots. And it's like, okay, well, if I'm only happy if I'm hitting it clean, then unfortunately I can't be happy today because it's windy. Like I don't want that to be tied to something that I'm not in control of.
And two, along those lines, one phrase that I love is winning ugly. Like I live my game by winning ugly. Like if I can play well, I'm great. But I feel like that's the first th personally, that was always the first thing that I taught others, because you have to understand that this is never going to be pretty and your game's never going to be perfect. And I feel like that's similar to playing smart.
Yeah, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. When I look at someone who is smart and a problem solver, that is beautiful to me. And when I see someone who hits the ball beautifully with great strokes and doesn't know what they're doing, that is like, I guess, ugly. I hate watching it. I used to call them when I was recruiting at Duke, I'd call them beautiful losers. And I was like, that
Interesting.
guy, I go, that guy looks great. Why does he never get past the round of 16? Like something must be that's it's not like, oh, look at all the ability. Oh my God, look at the projection. I actually used to get very worried. I'm like, he looks that good and he can't win. Like, there must be something going on upstairs, which to me can be almost more difficult to improve than a stroke. Like, I'd rather have the competitor with a jacked up backhand than someone with a beautiful backhand who is scared to put themselves on the line. Like, to me, that's actually a much more scary thing to change. So, yeah, I mean, like I said, people can enjoy it. Like it's a recreational sport. So if you just go, I live for the moment to hit five good forehands. That's the only reason. I go, that's awesome. Go do that. You're going to have a blast. You're also probably not going to win a ton of matches, but like, that's great. Like you can have fun with that.
And I like how you put that too, because ever since I started this and started talking to college coaches more about their process and recruiting, and like you said before, competitiveness is probably top two priorities for college coaches, because you want players that are going to face adversity, go through adversity, and still compete at the highest level. So when you have guys that have great technique, look good on court, but then compete very poorly, they will pass you up 9 times out of 10. And that, to me, if I ever went back to recruiting, if I ever went back to like college to play, I would say I needed to work more on my ability to play matches rather than look good on court.
Yeah, solving like it can be, competitiveness is such a huge thing, right? You could say it's problem solving, it's effort, it's resilience, it's emotional intelligence, like all these things. But there were plenty of times. I believe his name is Logan Staggs. He played for UCLA, but he was like, I don't want to offend him, but he was very short. I honestly think he was like 4'4" or 5'5", and he was probably 120 pounds, and he didn't look great. But he was winning a ton of junior matches and he wanted to come to Duke, or we were one of his options. And we're like, ah, I just don't know. Like, look how small he is. He doesn't do a whole lot. Like, is that going to hold up once you get to D1? And guess what? The guy went to UCLA and won like 150 matches. Like, the kid was a winner. The kid just got it done. He made balls. And like, I remember like after his sophomore year, I was like, I'll never make that mistake again. Like, when I see a guy who's getting it done, yes, like, he'll never be a pro. He's not currently playing pro tennis because that is too small and he didn't have enough game. But you can win at a really high level if you're an elite competitor. And so he taught me that lesson big time.
So going along those lines too, what besides technique and that perfection look, what creates blinders for coaches or for players when they watch tennis? What do, at least for players that you work with, what do they notice more about players that they really shouldn't be obsessed with, if that makes sense?
Yeah, so what do players, when they're watching a match, what do I think they're paying attention to?
Yeah, versus what they should be paying attention to.
I think they pay attention to everything that their opponent does well. And I look at everything they do horribly. Because if I watch Like last year, we were watching Pegula at US Open, and my wife was trying to get like some videos for her Instagram. And so she kept like leaning over the person in the row and like trying to take this video. And it was like double fault, miss return, miss plus one. She was playing Shelby Rogers. And she's like, oh, I just can't get a good point. And I'm like, yeah, unfortunately, that's the game of tennis. Even at that level, it's like, and then we sprinkle in this amazing rally or sprinkle in a couple winners, but it's a lot of missing. It's a lot of ugly. And so when I'm watching a match, I'm like, oh, they can't go forehand line, or oh, when they're on the run, or oh, if they lose 2 points in a row, they start, shaking their head, and we got an opportunity to get on them. Whereas I think players will look at it, and every time that forehand line gets hit, they're like, see, I told you she could hit it. And you're like, yeah, I know she can. It's just she can't do it every time, or she can't do it that
Exactly.
often.
She hits it
And
3 out of 10 versus 7 out of 10.
And so you have to be aware of everything for sure. But like, I would look at the things that I do well, and then I would look at the things that my opponent doesn't do well. And I'm like, okay, I can win this match. I'm still aware that my backhand sucks, but I'm like, oh, but my forehand cross is good. And I know that they only go cross court back off that. So I can sit over here, and then I can just kind of take my time when I want to go line. So I think most players probably reverse it. Oh, my serve sucks. Oh, my backhand feels terrible. And oh, look, that girl's just ripping balls in the corner. And it's like, that's also not reality. So I would say that I look at it maybe the opposite way that most players do.
It's like glass half full versus glass half empty, kind
Correct.
of in that sense. And I actually, moving on from coaching, because I know you have limited time now, I actually wanted to talk to you about starting your Instagram, kind of to look at the business side of it. What made you kind of pursue or kind of go full throttle with the Instagram account, and what made you kind of see this as a business versus just, oh, this could just be for fun?
Okay, so the origin of my Instagram account, because I've never understood personal social media. Like, oh, I'm gonna put a picture up on Instagram. I'd be like, no, I'm gonna text it to the person who I want to see that. So I've never understood like broadcasting that to the world. So I never had Instagram. When I left Duke, I came to LTP in Mount Pleasant, and it wasn't exactly what I thought it was gonna be. And two girls hired me privately, and I was coaching them on this court right by the beach. Like, just bring my balls in the car. And I was like, how did I get here? Like, this is not how I envisioned my life. And one of them, the dad, was kind of like, well, you've got to start an Instagram page. And like, so people know you live here. Like, you just moved here during COVID. You don't even belong to a club. Like, how is anyone else going to be able to take a lesson from you or whatever? So the girls were literally like, oh, post a picture of this, or make a video of me doing this. And so they were just telling me what to do like once a week. So if you scroll, if you ever feel like scrolling back 1,000 posts, you'll see like that's them telling me what to do. And then one of the videos like got a couple thousand views, and I was like, oh, that's fun. And then the competitive side of me was just like, oh, it's kind of like a game. Like, I got a message here or there. Someone liked the tip that made me feel good. I'll make another video. I started to get some more followers, and I was like, oh, maybe like someone will give me a free pair of shoes, 'cause like my shoes are running out. So like, if I get enough followers, maybe someone will want that. I would say turning it into a business, I would say in the last year and a half.
Really?
So yeah, in terms of like what I could do with an audience, like before is like, oh, great, I have 60,000 followers. Like, what does that get me? Like, nothing really. It gets you nothing. But then last year, it might have been in November of 23, I was kind of like, oh, I wonder if anyone who follows me would like to come work with me and do a camp. So I was like, oh, I'll just put a little video up on Instagram that I'm going to do a doubles camp in Charleston. And I had that sell out like literally within a couple days. And so I was like, oh, wow, like maybe people actually like that. So then it was, oh, maybe I'll do one in New York City, and maybe I'll do one in Indian Wells. And it was sold out, but we had a couple injuries, but we had 44 people show up to Indian Wells this year for the camps, which was awesome.
Incredible.
And I was like, oh, now I have a platform, and people, I guess, hopefully like that content or resonate with either my delivery or what I'm saying. And so, yeah, using that to get introduced to more passionate players who are already kind of aligned with what I'm teaching is kind of where it's gone. But yeah, in the beginning, it was just kind of like, oh, I'm just gonna give out free content, and that makes me feel good. And if someone writes a message on my DM and says that they want a match they never used to win, I'm like, oh, that's kind of why I do it.
And do you ever get sucked in to Instagram? I feel like I have to ask anyone that works on the platform, because I feel like it's, for me, I've always recently, now that I've been doing this a bit longer, I feel like I've been getting sucked in a lot faster than I should
In
be.
terms of spending time on the app?
Yeah.
I mean, I go on there, I check it briefly many times a day.
Okay.
And I respond to almost every DM.
Which I appreciate, by the way.
Right. Comments I'm responding to less and less just because I have less time, which I've heard you're supposed to, but I just realistically don't. I don't get too sucked into consuming a whole lot. Like I don't start like scrolling through reels. I mean, maybe like my whole feed is like puppies and like paddle highlights, like basically.
I
So
love
like
that.
sometimes I'll like watch a bunch of dog videos, but like I basically just go on there and it's like, did anyone DM me? Are there any opportunities that popped up? No. How's that video doing after 4 hours? Good, not great. Oh, interesting. Make a note. Maybe I should do more of those. That's how I'm not on there as a consumer for enjoyment. It's
Okay.
literally just like,
A
how's
business.
everything going? Yeah, exactly. 100%.
I feel like that's very hard to kind of, it's hard to do because it's on a social media based platform and a lot of people use it for creativity and more like, oh, look what we're doing versus you giving information and showing people, okay, this is what we're doing. This is how we can express that. And
Right.
for you creating the content, do you do that all yourself or do you have someone helping you through this process?
If you watch my content, you would probably know I do it myself because it's really not that spectacular. Especially my YouTube, it's not the highest quality video or whatever editing. And yeah, usually what happens is like I'm sitting here and I'm watching a match and I go, oh, like that was a terrible backhand line. And then I'm like, yeah, I wish people didn't do that so much. And so I might go to the court and just do a selfie video and be like, hey, here are the three times you should go down the line. Or I have a lesson and they're struggling with something. I'm like, you know what? I'm sure everyone struggles with that. And then sometimes unfortunately the ones that do the best are just, if I have a video of a pro player hitting a ball, people just want to watch a good shot.
Yeah.
But it is tough to come up with, you know, Instagram is content every day. So, okay, well, now I'm doing it for 3 years. Are there 1,000 things to teach you? The answer is no. Now, the good news is most people don't see my content every time. So I can repost something about poaching every 4 weeks and the same people aren't seeing it. So I get that.
Okay.
YouTube is the fun one for me because I can actually do a 15-minute video and really explain what I hope crystal clearly, a point that maybe people don't understand.
Yeah.
And I don't have to hook them in 3 seconds necessarily, which is the difficulty of Instagram.
Yes.
So I enjoy my YouTube way more than my Instagram.
Okay.
But my Instagram audience is way larger and definitely helps allow me to advertise my own stuff, which is great. But it's just so difficult to give you a life-changing piece of information where I reel you in 3 seconds and then can fully explain the idea in 25. Like
Yeah.
that's just very, very hard to do.
So how do you structure your day? I feel like from teaching to creating to editing, do you work 12 hours a day?
Okay, so I yes and no. I used to. So
okay.
When I like a couple years ago, I was on court 7 a.m. to 7 p.m.
Jesus.
No break. No break. Which, by the way, I don't recommend, but if you ever had to do it, don't take a break. Because once you stop for 30 minutes, you're like, that was nice. Like,
yeah.
You just almost want to forget what it's like to sit down and like turn your brain off for a little bit. So when I started the podcast 3 years ago, I originally was working like 12 to 6. So I was like, oh, I've got time in the mornings. I can mess around. And this is before Served and nothing major. And I was like, oh, you know, like I don't think there's a lot of amazing podcasts I can do it. And the second I committed and put out a couple episodes, a couple players said, hey, can we get 4 hours every morning?
Yeah.
So now all of a sudden I have no time, right? Like I'm getting off the court. I'm doing an episode. I edit those myself. Trying to get videos done. Like that was insane. A lot of my players have gone on to college. I haven't replaced them. And so now really my days are fairly wide open.
Okay.
So now, you know, I work 1 day a week is super busy. The other days I do a couple lessons. I do my camps throughout the year. So I have a lot of time, like on this day, this is a Monday, to do something like this last second. And then also I have the freedom where there's a couple of good players who might say, hey, can I come in next week for a week? And I'm like, yeah, I'm open. That sounds fun. And if someone asks me to come down and it doesn't sound like a fun opportunity, I'm like, I'm sorry, I'm busy. Like, I don't have the time for that. But so now I have more time, which is great, because then I can spend more time going, what does someone need to hear on YouTube today? Like, what is a common problem I'm seeing that I can now invest enough time into actually help random strangers that I'll never meet? Whereas when I was on court for 12 hours, a lot of those hours weren't productive. And then I'd come off and like just try to throw something together online because I had to, you know?
Exactly. And scheduling that out, I feel like when you have a full open day and you just have so much content to create, I personally struggle with that.
It's
It's
really hard.
really hard because you have to prioritize, okay, what do I need to get out within the next 2 days? Okay, what can I push out for the next five? How can I create pieces of content each day without doing all of it in one day? And how do I structure that? And for you, do you just, you said you do everything one day now and then you kind of spread it out in that
So
regard?
yeah, so I mean I wish I could tell you I had like a really great system. So like the month of March for me is crazy because I was in Indian Wells for 10 days. We had those three camps. I came back. I had my two Charleston camps. I had two people flying from out of town in between those for a lot of lessons. So I was on court a lot. And so like I'm just like piecing it together with my Instagram stuff. I'm like I got too much going on outside of that. I'm actually thinking about trying to go through a phase where I put out a lot of content, maybe two or three pieces a day, just to see what happens as an experiment, which I would experiment with anything in my life. But when I do that, yeah, I would plan it and be like, okay, here are the topics I want to do. Try to get ahead, which is really tough because a lot of times I'm not. A lot of times, like, it's 7 in the morning and I'm like, oh, like, you know, add captions to the video and like, let's just go ahead and post this now. But now that I have a little more free time is when I will plan and go, okay, here might be what I want to do this week. I will try to get it all done on that Monday or Tuesday, and then maybe take 2 days and just get away from the app and then kind of restart that process. But I like it when I have like a 7 to 10 day grace period where I'm like, I've got stuff planned. But the other problem too is kind of like when you know, if I ask you what you want to eat for dinner next Wednesday, 10 days from now, that's really tough to know what you're going to want. So like sometimes I schedule something and then I see that it's about to post and I'm like, that doesn't seem interesting today. Like I don't want to post that. I want to post what I was thinking about yesterday. And so I almost like lose the passion for whatever that topic was. So sometimes I do like when it's spur of the moment, because for me it's really resonating. I'm like, man, my player kept missing the net. I want to post that now. I
It's
don't
like the
want to wait.
passion for like that topic you wanna
Yeah, I don't
get
want to wait
out.
another 10 days for people to keep banging the ball in the net. Like, I just saw it. I have a video. I think it's helpful. I want to press send now instead of talking about that poaching tip from 10 days ago, which I've kind of already moved on from. So it's tricky. It's very tricky.
It's tricky because it's like strategy versus what you want to post. So
Yes.
it's always going to be tough in that sense. And I relate to that so much too. And Jonathan, I can't thank you enough for joining us today. A lot of great content here, and I just appreciate you taking time out of your morning to do it. It's early for some people, but we were able to do this on the spur of the moment, and I really do appreciate it. If you want to follow Jonathan on social media, check out his Instagram down in the description below, or if you're listening to this on the Ball Was Out podcast, make sure to check it out in the description and bio. So, Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us today. I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Absolute blast.
I'll talk to you soon, bud. Thanks, man.